Legendary cinematographer Gordon Willis has died. He passed away this past weekend at the age of 82. There are a select few creative talents in the industry from the past 40 years that are worthy of the title legendary, and he is certainly one of them. Films like Clute, The Parallax View, The Devil's Own, Annie Hall, Manhattan, and of course, the big game changers, The Godfather 1, 2, and 3. He was known as the Prince of Darkness because he was unafraid of not overlighting everything, particularly in comedy, which is the trend with that genre. Tonight we'll be celebrating his output, discussing our thoughts on it, and we'll be playing an interview with Gordon Willis that we've never before aired on this show, where he talks about the Godfather restoration. This was an interview conducted about 4 years ago by Aaron Ada-Diaz, a frequent correspondent of this show, and we'll be premiering it tonight. So let me bring this up first. If you need any evidence of the wrongheadedness of the Academy, just look at how they treated Gordon Willis. All of these classic films, and he was nominated twice. And what was he nominated for? You guys know?
He was nominated for Zelig in The Godfather Part III. Zelig was his first nomination, and a very special one. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, about the Academy, they, you know, those old guard guys that were around, you know, in the 60s and the 50s and were in the 40s and the 30s and were still around, you know, voting on things in the 70s when Gordon Willis came around, you know, they were just livid over his technique, which was, you know, true to his name, The Prince of Darkness, you know. They were just mad that, you know, Marlon Brando was in the movie and you could hardly see him. So it was the same thing that the studio executives were mad about. They just had never seen anything like it. So they were just pissed off at him, you know. Pissed off at him for being a maverick and a forward thinker.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what happens in this world. When you're doing something that groundbreaking and everything, people are jealous, they don't understand, and they just become haters. But, I mean, let's be honest. When you talk about cinematography today, that's the first name that pops up. I mean, that's who you want to be. That's, you know, when you think of cinematography, Gordon Willis. I mean, those the Godfather films alone, those films just were just, the look and everything was, I mean, it's like, he is really the star of the 70s, as far as I'm concerned. He is really his eye. We owe him everything.
I mean, I would go so far as to say he's the most influential American photographer of the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just before Gordon Willis and after Gordon Willis. And, like, I mean, before that, you can go to Greg Toland or maybe Robert Burks. I don't even know if Robert Burks was American. And then Robert Surtees, and then Comrade Hall, of course,
right.
Who would be a major contender. And maybe Bruce Surtees kind of broke the ground a little bit in the late 60s for that darkness,
right.
The darkness, you know. But yeah, Gordon Willis changed it all. Changed every single aspect of movies.
And for those people that think that he was just all about darkness, I mean, a great chunk of one of his great films, which is All the President's Men, is pretty much as brightly lit as you could possibly get. I mean, because a lot of it takes place in the Washington Post office building.
Right.
But then, of course, he has the parking garage footage with
Right.
Deep Throat and the very mysterious, shadowy environment of that. But it's very interesting because that's one of my favorite movies, All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
What I love,
for sure.
One of the things I really love about it is the how he makes it, most of the movie, these people are just talking on telephones, trying to get leads.
Mm-hmm.
And how he makes that so visually arresting. There's like a split diopter shot that he does where Redford's in the foreground and all the activity behind him in the office, and everything is totally in focus. And actually, this and there's such a depth to that shot, and actually this brings up an unintended flaw in the Blu-ray process, because watching the Blu-ray for the first time when it came out years ago, it was so clear that I saw like a piece of plexiglass or something right behind Redford, separating Redford from the background, and I only noticed it because there was like a smudge or a flash of light or something on it. which is interesting.
Yeah, that's the negatives of Blu-ray, because they can show the flaws that weren't intended, but that were covered up by the grain of film and so forth. But I mean, All the President's Men too. You know, it was shot under fluorescent light, which, you know, all of that is a set, by the way. That's the Washington Post. You know, that movie won the Oscar for best art direction that year because they built that set, you know, and it's all lit by fluorescent light. So Gordon Willis, I don't know if he created this or if he maybe just popularized it or whatever after that film, but he utilized, you know, very special gels on those fluorescent lights, because before then, you know, if you shot under fluorescent light, it would turn green. You'd have a green tint to everything. So I mean, whether he created it or not, you have to imagine just the massive problem of shooting under that much fluorescent light, you know. And then, but yet, yeah, then he's got those great dark sequences with Deep Throat, where the lighting is so delicate on Hal Holbrook's face. So delicate, so careful not to show too much, but yet not to obscure the actor and his performance. And it's a ridiculous, like, confluence of things in that movie of his abilities. It's just, you know, it's one of his most superb movies.
Going back to the comedies, too, because... You know, something to credit Woody Allen with, and this started really with Gordon Willis, is that for someone that makes typically light fare, he's always paid attention to the visuals in a way that comedies normally don't. So he's even said that when he decided to hire Gordon Willis for Annie Hall, they were like, "Why the hell are you? Why the hell are you going with someone so whose work is so distinctive for your little rom-com?" You know, and but, you know, very special things came out of that collaboration, and they worked a lot together. And if you think of something like the black and white and Broadway Danny Rose, or Manhattan, of course Manhattan, and, you know, there's scenes between he and Diane Keaton. And another interesting thing about Gordon Willis's work with Woody Allen is Woody Allen would allow Gordon Willis to block the scenes. So, which is kind of unheard of, because it's usually like a light collaboration with the cinematographer, where the director presents his ideas and the DP says, "Okay, we can make that work," or, "I would suggest this." But Woody Allen would turn over scenes to Gordon Willis and say, "Block this." And so there'd be a conversation in the kitchen going on between Diane Keaton and Woody Allen. And they'd be talking back and forth, and Woody Allen would exit the frame, and they'd still be talking. And Woody Allen said, but they won't be able to see me when I'm talking. And Gordon Willis said, "No, they won't."
It'll just be an empty hallway.
But he said, "No, they won't, but they'll be able to hear you, and that's what's important." And so a scene that could have been just a run-of-the-mill single shot of two people in a kitchen became something specific, and that's what Gordon Willis did for Woody Allen.
I mean, you just think about Woody Allen, you know, and again, you know, there's pre-Gordon Willis Woody Allen, which would be everything before Annie Hall, and then there's afterwards, and you look at that output, that eight film or somewhere like around eight movies with Woody Allen, and you just, you know, everything about the thing about Gordon Willis's photography is that everything that he did, you know, I mean, even though he was working, he worked in certain genres like comedy. He did a couple of westerns, although they were very odd westerns. You know, crime films, although, you know, I really look at Godfather as being a film about a family. But you look at all of those movies, and they really shouldn't have the level of seriousness that he brings to the movies. But there's just something about the photography, the use of light and the use of no light and the playing around with exposures when things are really bright and stuff, that all that stuff just works together to give a sense of seriousness.
Right.
You know,
but isn't that
the
point?
Serious, yeah.
But the point that makes these films different, you just the look, and that's such a big, that is the game changer. That is all the difference, the way you say he brings this to give them this serious look. And like you said, Godfather is a film about family, but, you know, let's be honest, it is, before you get to Coppola, it is a genre film, a gangster film, and he brings it, you bring Gordon Willis in, and it changes everything because of the look. And they don't, and I also think that's why these films also hold up so well, too. These films don't look dated. If you, you know, they hold up incredibly well. And I think
Yeah,
and I think that's a huge, huge part is Willis's work. I mean, even the Woody Allen films, all of them actually. If you look at his whole resume, those films, all the films that look horribly big, his don't, and that's a big, big thing. The Drowning Pool, things like that. It's just incredible, and you do have
that. Or the paper chase, you know.
The paper chase. Well, yeah. I mean, that looks. It's the look of the film is what is the first thing that's always going to come to mind. And you'll watch something, you go, oh, that, you know, God, this is, you'll look at something in the clothes or something, you know, oh, it's dated, the look, even the look. But here, the quality is such upper echelon. It's amazing that his work stands the test of time. And it goes to the Fukula films, all of them. Presumed Innocent.
Well, and also, I mean, I always said that if you want to know the absolute transporting magic of a series of images on film, like almost like otherworldly, like whatever stars aligned, something absolutely magical and unimaginable in any other medium has occurred. I always say, look at the Ellis Island segments of Godfather 2.
Yes.
It's like you are transported to, like, other time. It is flawless and unforced, not gimmicky. It's just amazingly recreated. And that's Gordon Willis, man. The color tones of the three Godfathers, if you look at the color tones of the three Godfathers, and how they express how that saga is unfurling, the various themes going on, how it's getting progressively darker. Like if you look at the scene where Fredo is sitting in the chair, all feeble, and he's saying, "I'm at the end of Godfather 2, I'm smart, I was passed over." And Michael's standing above him in shadow, and he looks down and says, "I don't want to see you anymore. You're not part of his family." My God. And then the third one has a very different look as well. It's all golds and maroons. It's very royal, regal.
It's very
kind of,
and the scene where Michael, you know, passes over power to Vincent, it gets very dark with Michael, and then as Vincent, you know, takes over, it's, you know, the door, you know, the light and everything coming through. It's a very beautiful, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't think anyone else could have done those films now, you know, I mean, they're just that, he has his touch on them.
Well, certainly, I mean, Coppola obviously realized that no one could have done those films. He only did three films with Willis, and they were all the Godfather movies, so he obviously believed that Willis was was crucial to making The Godfather exactly what it is. And if you if you think about that too, I mean, think about when he hired Gordon Willis in 71 or whatever it was to do it. Just think about what Gordon Willis had come out with. There are largely movies that most of us haven't seen, things like End of the Road or The People Next Door or Loving. You know, the really major first really major movie, I mean, and we only know this because we know the director, Hal Ashby, was The Landlord. So you really have to hand it to Coppola too, because Coppola obviously saw something in him very early that he was willing to go and fight for, you know. He was willing to go and fight for the quality that he brought to it. And I wonder if Coppola and Willis had, you know, discussions about, you know, well, how far are we going to go with this darkness thing or whatever? Because I think that's a really interesting thing. I wonder if they had any really real debates about it, or whether they really got along.
Well, especially then. I mean, cinematography is so different now because you have such immediate results and you can know what's working as you're doing it. But back then, when it's always a question mark if it's going to print right, and you have to wait days to get it back and figure it out, it was a particular risk to shoot like that. And he got to know what you're getting is right and not too dark, because everyone thought it was too dark. I mean, in the studio, I mean, everybody pressured him, like, you can't see anything, like, what's going on here?
And surely, you know, he had enough. He obviously had enough knowledge of photography, also the printing of film and the color timing and so forth, and the pushing exposures and things like that that could make certain things work that initially may not have looked like they were going to work. All of those directions pretty much came from him. So he was obviously an expert
But with film, there's always a question mark. I mean, obviously you know how to capture what you want to capture, but there's a lot of other variables at play. And even he said that he went too dark in a scene in Godfather, the first Godfather, I think the first Godfather, where he goes in to talk to his mother.
That was the second one where he goes to talk to Mama. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, he questioned his own. Maybe I went too far there. that's interesting to know. I mean, but, you know, about the Godfather movies, too, he was able to, and, you know, a lot of his other movies, too, but specifically with the Godfather movies, he was able to sort of compartmentalize the different sequences. You know, if you think about the wedding sequence in the first one and how over lit it is, like sort of a little overexposed it is. And then you think about, like, also, like, I always thought it was an interesting sequence in two, which a lot of people don't talk about, is the Senate sequence, the Senate hearing sequence, because it's got this sort of raw, newsy sort of feel to it that's like, that doesn't have the quality of any of the other photography in any of the other sequences in any of the movies. You know, it's got this sort of like, I can't like put my finger on it, but it's got this sort of like sort of hazy kind of milky look to it. That's interesting, you know.
Right.
And really brings forth the sort of the documentary quality of it. And then of course, you know, you also have the Lake Tahoe sequence in two, you know, that has really bright colors to it and Fredo's death on the lake, you know, which is, you know, shot almost dreamily. And I always think about too, like like a couple of things in the first one, like the shot of the producer's house in L.A. and Godfather 1, like
mm-hmm.
as we're creeping up and we're about to find the horse's head in the bed. But it's just those beautiful sunset sort of shots of that house going into it and using a very gentle sort of zoom to, which he didn't use a lot of zooms and tricks in his photography. It was pretty much everything was on sticks in a lot of ways, you know, pans and tilts, but no, not a lot of dollies and zooms and stuff like that.
What director do you wish he would have worked with?
That's an interesting question.
Scorsese, and I would say Scorsese and De Palma. I mean,
Scorsese would have been an interesting choice.
Would have been interesting if he would have done a Fincher movie.
Well,
yeah.
You know, there are so. I mean, Fincher is the guy that comes to mind. Obviously, he's the first one of you know. 90s era directors that you would think of. I mean, he's certainly there because you said in certain movies, The Game or Seven or especially Zodiac is one that really comes to mind, and I think he would have been a natural for him. What he would have done with that? But it's interesting. Yes, Fincher is of all that of his generation, is certainly the one that comes the first one at least to my mind, and maybe Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, There Will Be Blood is a natural for a Gordon Willis. Feel.
Well, you know, I mean, I think Fincher would have been, I mean, obviously Fincher is sort of like the, you know, the sort of the torch carrier of that style a little bit, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and that use of darkness. And then I guess you could go to somebody like Nolan or somebody like that, or maybe even like, you know, would it have been weird for him to do a David Lynch movie? That would have been strange. But I was thinking about that question. I was thinking you might ask that, and I was thinking, boy, wouldn't it have been interesting if you had done a Robert Altman movie, just one Robert Altman movie, you know? That would have been. But then again, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, there's just too much camera movement there. I just don't think he would have been interested in that. I mean, Altman's camera never stops moving, so, you know, in whatever form. So I don't know if he would have worked, if that would have worked, really. So, but I think Scorsese is a good pick. You know, I think he could have done something with movies.
Well, just a couple more movies. Presumed Innocent, which has always been a movie I've loved.
Mm-hmm.
I think of one shot in particular where Harrison Ford's hearing his wife's confession at the end, and it's
mm-hmm.
a shot that just holds on Harrison Ford as like tears are welling in his eyes. It's very powerful. A movie like Bright Lights, Big City, which is like the antithesis of a lot of the other movies that we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a very 80s pop movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the scenes in the hospital with the mother with the rain on the window and in relation to location and you know, the New York City being such a character in that film.
Don't forget The Pickup Artist. That's a good. That's an interesting one too.
Yeah, I mean, I would pick. You know, if the two that I would say are the most underrated and most interesting. Maybe a lot of listeners maybe haven't seen these movies because they're by directors that, you know, they haven't investigated their entire oeuvre or whatever. But, you know, Robert Benton's Bad Company in 72 was a good opportunity for him to do a Western and also to get out of the cities, you know, and get more wide open spaces. Because if you look at his career, there weren't a lot of wide open spaces. I mean, outside of Bad Company and maybe Comes a Horseman for
mm-hmm.
Pacula, like there's not a lot of vistas and mountains and things like that and open spaces and big skies. So And, you know, of course, Bad Company also has a lot of great, you know, interior shots that really recall Willis's work. But also I'd have to say, you know, to me, like, one of his masterpieces is Herbert Ross's Pennies from Heaven, which I really think gave him a real workout. I mean, it's the movie where you really feel a sense of true collaboration between the cinematographer, the art director, and the costume designer, and just about everybody else that's on there. And so many different styles of and lighting schemes and odd situations, you know. Very, very underrated work by him that that, you know, I mean, that Christopher Walken dance scene alone, you know, but then, you know, there's the Bernadette Peters and the kids dancing on all the white pianos and stuff, and it's all white and blinding, and but then there's the reality sequences that have more of a Gordon Willis feel to them. So, you know, I mean, things like that. And also I have to just say Woody Allen's interiors, too. I just have to point that out. It's also like a confluence of him working with the art director and the costume designer to create a very unique feel to one of Woody Allen's movies. Definitely one of Woody Allen's most rigidly designed movies, like from top to bottom.
Right.
And you know, the whole climax and all the things on the beach with the crazy filters that create a sort of a dark quality to the clouds in those beach scenes and just the haunting quality of almost every frame of that movie. But, you know, I mean, you could say that about, you know, probably Danny Rose and Purple Rose of Cairo and Manhattan and all of those movies that he did with Woody Allen. It's just a ridiculously extraordinary career.
Well, let me ask a question, because I don't know this. Why did he stop? Why did he – is there a particular reason that he retired after The Devil's Own, besides probably the obvious one? But is there – has he ever said that he – did he officially just step down or –
I just think he retired. I just think it came time to retire. I mean, a close friend of his, Alan Davia, retired as well. And he's in on this interview as, too. And he retired around the same time. I think his last movie he did was Fearless.
You know, we have to remember, and we talked a little bit about this on the last show, Jerry, the show that we just did. You know, I just think that, you know, there comes a time in all Hollywood careers in which everybody needs to consider the possibility of simply retiring, especially after you've gotten a number of great movies like Mr. Willis had in his back pocket. There just comes a point where you say, well, I'm just not enjoying it anymore, or the movies aren't the same, or I don't know that this is my time. Or it's interesting that he and Pacula have shared their last movie together. I think that's an interesting point.
That is an interesting point, and I wonder, and that's like something we have talked about over our 7-year history. What if, though, he had, you know, if he wasn't in a, you know, if he had lived, though, I mean, the movies we would have gotten from him into the new century would have been incredible, I think.
Well, I did just want to say, you know, I did get to meet Gordon Willis very briefly I at the Museum of Modern Art in about the early 90s, I would say, maybe 91 or 92, somewhere around there. And I can't remember a whole lot about it because I was very starry-eyed and everything, but I did get an autograph on a half sheet for Manhattan, which contains, you know, what I consider to be his most famous shot of the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, and the couple sitting there on the bench in front of it. And so, and I just took a look at that piece. It's been rolled up in my house like for the past 2 decades, and it's still totally intact, and it looks good. But I was just looking at it last week, so that's a treasure. Yeah, we'll miss Gordon Willis. I mean, we've missed him for many years now, and and we will continue to do so.
I'll start with you, Mr. Willis, we'll, to talk about just The Godfather before we get to the restoration of The Godfather, and that, how did you come about getting this particular gig? Because you had done a few pretty big films, The Landlord before this and a couple others. So how did you get The Godfather assignment?
I just happened to be standing in the right place at the right time. You know, there's no real backstory to that. And to this day, I couldn't lace it together myself. You know, it was in fact, I turned the job down.
Really?
Yeah, I was shooting some commercial work, and I turned it down. But then I turned around, had another conversation, and decided to do it. But there was no real summit meeting. It just
right. Now, because of your photography on the Godfather film, particularly the first one, you got dubbed this Prince of Darkness because of the dark interiors.
Yeah, that was Connie Hall. It was a friend of mine, but I didn't mind him saying that. But I guess
they're going to pass it around. You see, this is the interesting
exactly.
part.
Yeah.
And I understand the famous story is that when the studio saw this, they were mad because it's not going to play well at drive-ins. Is this correct?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't only that. I used to get that a lot in movies that I was working on, that, you know, they can't see it at the drive-ins, but they're not watching the screen in the drive-ins anyway, was my answer. So I never really paid much attention to it.
Right. On the commentary for part one, Francis makes mention that you're the way he puts it affectionately, that you're a stickler for whose POV is it. Is this something that you still, that whenever a shot is being set up, and you always ask whose POV is it? And in some cases, Francis said, "Well, it's my POV or it's God's POV or whatever."
Well, to be more specific about it, usually it wasn't necessarily POV. I was usually asking, "What is this cut with?" Or, you know, "What's the cut before this and what's the cut after it?" You know,
right?
So, which is generally important, and so that I was always pressing for that kind of information, and we get it, you know, before we do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Something other cinematographers always observe is how much information is contained in every shot.
Right.
You don't have a wasted shot with Mr. Willis.
The Godfather, in that all these dark interiors, was this a stylistic choice, or was this something that when you got on set, you realized, well, these are dark rooms, so let's just keep them dark and not overlight them, you know?
No, it was a conscious choice to do it that way.
Okay.
A conscious choice to juxtapose this dark library where the Don hung out with a wedding outside that was bright and cheery, et cetera, et cetera. So the bottom line, it was a conscious piece of design to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this restoration process, from what I've read, it was the official word has been, I guess, 2 years plus in the making, but from what I understand, the story I've heard is that back in 97, when I guess it was because of the wake of the Star Wars re-release success, that people thought, well, we can re-release other big films and see what happens, and that Godfather was struck, new prints were struck from the negative for the 25th anniversary, and that people noticed that they weren't looking quite good and were kind of concerned, and then concern grew over time, and that and so Francis wanted to do this work on his restoration.
Yeah, to be honest about it, the 25th anniversary thing was kind of it was a very bad thing to do, because it was doing a 25th anniversary but not really doing it, so
right.
It was a bad choice to do it that way without really restoring anything. So it was kind of a ragged operation. I think from that point on, it was sort of put away. And to be honest with you, it surfaced several times, but never really got out of the chute. And I really didn't. And I had made some restoration with some of the laser discs that came out, and later a first set of DVDs that came out with the material that was available to work with. with Paramount. But the overall restoration of the movie was not attempted, so there were a lot of not such good things in there, you know. But I just sort of picked up the phone one day in the middle of this latest restoration, and a gentleman by the name of Bob Harrison had been hired to put this all back together again, and Alan worked very closely with him, and I couldn't get to California, so they were an enormous help to me. In fact, I don't think, without Alan being there and looking at it, I don't think I could have been of any. I was a final help when they were finally got it to the point where it was time to print the movie, but they had done most of the work at that point. We had a lot of conversations over the phone, etc. But I think Steven Spielberg was actually responsible for getting it kicked into position at Paramount after talking to Francis, who wanted to do it.
Right.
And we should mention Steven's head of post-production for DreamWorks, Marty Cohen, who was a champion for this restoration.
Right.
And when not everybody at a studio wants to spend money on something like this, but they saw that it was done and that Bob's work with the Paramount Digital Division, where Jan Yarborough worked out the techniques with Bob Harris of using a mixture of film and digital technology.
Yeah,
because the negatives of 1 and 2 were very badly damaged, and it took away a while to get away to get the image removed from these damaged perforations. And it's one of the real triumphs that it is as clean and solid and safe as it is now. We'd still like to have more time to do color corrections, but that's always the case.
Yeah, right.
But
maybe one of y'all can give me an example of a scene from one or from part one or part two to where it's a night and day of what it was when you first got it to what it now looks like on these.
Well, I think Alan's closer to that than
well, Gordon, wouldn't you think it's the scene of the shooting in the Italian restaurant of the police captain and
right.
Mobster? Is a scene that really had strayed a little bit from your original intentions.
Yeah, what happened there, actually, we had a double whammy there because actually when we were shooting the movie, it was split, it was shot in 2 days, and it was the first section and the second section. And the second section actually was underdeveloped we never really reshot it, so part of it was duped in order to match the first section, and it didn't hold up over time, so when they went back into it, they rebuilt the sections, and they're remarkably better now.
I noticed that, Stephen. The one thing that really stuck out when I was watching the Blu-ray was the, I guess you could say, the vividness of the red of the blood from the gunshot of Sollozzo. I don't think I'd ever seen it look that that clear and that kind of.
I mean, the spray when he was shot.
Yeah,
that was kind of an interesting story because at the time we were shooting it, the effects man, who happened to be a really really fine effects guy, by the name of A.D. Flowers. They were going by the narrative of the shooting and this, I can't remember the how it was written, but this spray of blood all over the room that you could see when it happened. Well, he had everything stuffed into this to make it work, and it didn't work. And I finally was thinking, I suggested that he take a tempera, powdered red tempera that hadn't been mixed yet, which is like face powder, but it's red. And so it's like dust, So he finally ended up packing everything with that, and it worked extremely well. But, yeah, you're right. Over a period of time, you lose detail like that, until the restoration was done. That's good.
Is there, just to get off Godfather for a second, and because you have such a, obviously, distinguished body of work, Mr. Willis, is there a title that you wish you could go back and maybe see if it needs restoration. I'm thinking, in my mind, I'm thinking of something like, do you know the status of something like Pennies from Heaven or some of your Woody Allen work, if they're in
Well, I don't think they're not in a condition that actually, I would hesitate to use the word restore. I would probably at this point say, you know, redo them in high debt. I mean, redo them, you know, redo them. But I don't think they're in that bad a condition. I might be mistaken, but I don't think so. They just should be redone in Blu-ray, you know, and properly timed, et cetera. Some of the DVDs are pretty good, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Much better condition than, I mean, The Godfather and A's had to be, you know, scraped off the wall at Paramount. They were not in good condition. So it's very hard to compare that with, you know, some of the ones you mentioned. Yeah.
Right. And so how was this a 2-year process, or was this even longer than people are? I mean, because 2 years is kind of what people are saying. But if I remember correctly, Spielberg got on the Paramount lot, I guess, 3 years ago, and supposedly that's when Francis kind of reached out to him. So I mean,
I don't know. Alan would know that more than me.
Yeah,
I think that's what started it. Was when Steven got there, and Francis had already said, you know, how hard he'd worked to try and get something to happen, and it hadn't happened. And it was definitely Steven's, you know, clout that when it occurred, and he said he pointed Marty Cohen in charge of the restoration, said, "We're going to restore the Godfather trilogy to the what we like to call opening day quality." And when you have films as great as the Godfather trilogy, to see that kind of care put into it is one of the most gratifying things. I mean, you have to understand that as a cinematographer, just watching Gordon's work at the time, what this meant, seeing Godfather 1, and I remember seeing Godfather 2 the day it opened in Chicago on a winter day, and then the impact of that picture was just not to be believed. And later on when I met Gordon, you know, I just said, do you have any idea how inspiring you are to everybody who wants to be a cinematographer? Because these are absolutely record-making films. I mean, just stunning. And to be able to be involved in the process of restoring them is a great, great joy. And it's just so gratifying to know that other generations will see them. Because one of the things that's so interesting is that generations of people have gone by without being able to see the film projected. And we're hoping to see this film get a theatrical re-release of some size, because to see people in their 20s and 30s looking at Godfather 1 on a big screen is quite a joy, because they let's put it this way, those movies still play like just 100%.
Yeah, they do.
It's wonderful to see it happen.
Well, I have a question about Godfather 2 in that, I was wondering what were the stylistic choices made or discussions about wanting to, at one hand, keep the consistency of the look from Godfather 1, but also my impression of Godfather 2 that it's always, that film has gotten, it has a colder look. It doesn't have that warm look of the film, and that because Michael has become very isolated, there's a lot of window panes, a lot of windows opening, and a lot of white, and it just has a very kind of cold and almost sterile look to some scenes, at least in the scenes of Michael as an adult. And I was wondering, how is that decided upon when you were filming Godfather 2?
Well, I don't know if you psychologically might hit you that way, but the truth of the matter is that both films are laced together with the same color structure. It's just
mm-hmm.
that. And they were meant to be, and as well as 3. Well, the only difference in 2, besides the time periods, going back to the 1900s, et cetera, where the quality of the photography was different, but and more retrospective in its look, the color was the same. So mm-hmm. we decided to keep that basically the same on all the movies. You don't want to be, it ties everything together. You don't want to be popping in and out, because it tends to get in the way. So my thought was, well, I think the color really should remain the same, and we can change the quality of the photography within that template, within that color structure. So basically, that's the quality of the the physical quality of photography was changed from, you know, when from 40s to the 50s, back to the 1900s, back to the 50s again, et cetera. That kind of thing was going on, but I think color-wise, it was essentially the same.
Well, go ahead, Al.
We should say here that one of the great assists we had was that Bob Harris found dye transfer prints of Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. That is from 1972 and 1974. That could be guides for us to see as a, you know, as reference when we were basically taking the digital scan of these movies and reintegrating the color, and we had something that showed us what Gordon had done in the original release period. Not that such a thing is perfect, but it was at least a basis on which we were able to proceed. And it was a wonderful thing to have. And as I said, to be able to see that and to know we were trying not to remake the movie, not to try and make it better, but just to try and do what Gordon had wanted to do back in the time of the original films.
Right. Well, looking to the future, Mr. Willis, I'm curious as a film fan, what's your take on, or do you have a take on digital photography and also and the video versus film, and also the process, the use of digital photography to sometimes replicate the look of older films. I'm thinking of something like Alan knows that I'm a big fan of this film, but something like Zodiac, which obviously is attempting to recreate some of the things that you did with something like All the President's Men. And so I was wondering, what is your take on the whole digital versus celluloid, and part of as photography goes?
Yeah, well, you know, it's another way to record images. It doesn't replace thinking. I think probably, you know, as I said, it's another way of recording images. A film is more organic than digital work at this point. But I don't. You'd have to be a fool to think that it's not going to finally disappear. Film in itself, it's overlapping right now, and people that like to shoot movies don't really like digital. But it's slowly getting there. As I said, it doesn't replace thinking. You still have to deal with it. I mean, you still have to, you know, you're using it to interpret something. So it's, as I said, I don't care if it's a roll of toilet paper that they're using. You know, it's just, point is, it's how you apply the medium that makes it work. You know, so I think a lot of film students, or a lot of people who ought to know better, actually, that are actually making a living, you know, thinks that it gets things out of their way so they can do what they want. Well, you really can't do what you want unless you figure out what you want to do, you know. It's like you get motion confused with accomplishment. It doesn't replace thinking, as I said, not to be redundant. I don't particularly care about it, but I shoot it at home all the time. I mean, I don't shoot film anymore at home. But, I mean, if I were to shoot a movie right now, I would do this film. I mean, it just has a sense to it and a definition to it, and it, as I said, it's very organic. And I think filmmakers, a lot of filmmakers today, have sort of distanced themselves from what's going on in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very close medium. You know, when you begin to separate everything, it doesn't work too well.
Well, do you have a favorite job of cinematography that you've seen the last 6 months or year that one is really kind of...
No. And I'm not saying that. I don't want people to misunderstand that. I just I go through it and make up a list of things I thought were quite nice. If you're talking about photography, you're talking about movies, because I really define movies as being interesting as opposed to photography. You know,
I'll rephrase. I guess movies. Has there been
an interesting movie? Well, I saw an interesting movie the other night, which is, probably doesn't fall into the category that you're asking, but it's called Man on Wire, which was about the guy that walked across the Trade Center.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, it was a fabulous docudrama. But there are not there are not a lot of great movies. I mean, you have to pick. You have to really pick through a pile as things go now. You know, and I think there's a lot of widescreen video movies, video games, widescreen. You know, a lot of blowing up, a lot of that, a lot of that. But I don't think there's much walking and talking going on in a lot of movies now, which I sort of the kind of movies that I like. But there are people making good movies. There's just not lots of them.
Is there a? Are you happy being? I'm assuming. I guess you're retired now.
Yeah, right.
Are you happy with that, or do you ever get the itch to try something, be it an indie or just something else?
Well, I don't think you ever get tired. You want to do it, but I don't do it anymore because I really can't. But the bottom line of it is I would always I've had to turn down a few things for various reasons, but I would love to do another movie. It's very tiring. I don't know whether I could hang in there like I used to. I certainly wouldn't mind it. You know.